the headlines, millions of Iranians have headed to the polls to elect members of the country's parliament and the Assembly of Experts. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says a high turnout in elections will make friends of the nation happy and disappoint the ill-wishers. And the number of Palestinian lives lost to the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip has topped 30,200 as deadly bombings continue unabated. Hello and welcome everybody, coming at you from our headquarters here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's election day in Iran. People are heading to the polls to cast their ballots for parliament and assembly of experts. Voters are taking part in the parliamentary election to choose 290 members of the legislative body from over 15,000 candidates. Elected members will serve for a term of 4 years in the parliament in another election, which is being held simultaneously. Participants are voting for the 88 members of the Assembly of Experts, a deliberative body elected for 8 years. This is the 12th parliamentary election and the sixth voting for the Assembly of Experts since the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. More than 61 million people are eligible to vote for both elections. Iranian voters have expressed their unwavering support for the Islamic Revolution by actively participating in the ongoing elections. Iranians say they deeply believe in the power of their collective voice and the democratic processes in the Islamic Republic. Let's take a listen to what they had to say.
With our votes, we want to show that despite problems and deficiencies in the country's governance, the people are wholeheartedly supporting the revolution, their national interests, and their country.
We have to fulfill our duty to the extent we can. Yes, there are many problems, too many problems. We're sad and we voice our criticism as much as we can. God willing, those responsible will think about them and probably many of them do care.
I feel that the participation is much better than last time and in my opinion, people are optimistic about the elections.
With all the propaganda that hostile media made, I think the turnout would be higher than the previous round.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has cast his ballot in the country's parliamentary and Assembly of Experts elections. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei voted in the Tehran constituency as soon as polls opened across the nation on Friday. Iran's Constitutional Council has the important role of overseeing the electoral process and confirming the final result of the elections. Our correspondent, Gisumi Shamhadi, and we were talking to the spokesperson of the council, Hadi Tahan Nazif, at a polling station in Tehran.
We've witnessed the voting of our people from the very early hours. And as you can see, in midday, we see such great crowds here. And this shows that people deem it important to use their right. The future of the country is important to them. The future of themselves and their children are important to them. Thank God that there's been no problem since the beginning of voting and everything has been smooth and facilitated and people are casting their ballots in the two parliamentary elections and the Assembly of Experts elections. Since the morning, we've been overseeing the elections. We have not seen any special irregularity since the morning. And some minor issues have been removed. We have not had any special problem. As well as the 230,000 public supervisors, we have also introduced a system so that all the 80 million population of Iran can supervise the election. So if there is any potential irregularity, they could document it for us.
Religious minorities in Iran are also casting their ballots alongside their fellow countrymen in the nation's legislative and assembly of experts elections. The Archbishop of Tehran says that elections are the sign of stability in any country.
Usually, elections taking place in any place, it is a sign of that country's stability. And now in Iran, when the election of the parliament is going on peacefully, rightly, this is a sign of the Iranian society's well-being. Therefore, it is important to participate in the election. Election, as I said, it's a sign of sound society. And thanks God that in Iran, the election that is taking place, it's a sign of the sound of society in Iran.
Moving on, the situation remains volatile along Lebanon's southern border. That's where the resistance movement Hezbollah and Israel have been engaged in almost daily clashes since early October. In its latest operation, Hezbollah has targeted a gathering of Israeli troops. For more on that, we're now joined from Beirut by our correspondent Mariam Saleh with all the latest details. Mariam, what do you have to share with us?
Well, the day began with a Hezbollah statement saying that they have taken down another Israeli drone. They did not specify what type of drone or that they do have the parts. That was done in the middle of the night. They said that they have taken it down over the valley of Al-Azi. That is considered, of course, part of Hezbollah's new strategy of taking down the drones that are constantly hovering over the heads of the people in South Lebanon, even reaching areas of Beirut and even northern Lebanon. Now, other, of course, operations have been very significant. Today, we had an extensive targeting of Israeli soldiers. Hezbollah declared and has confirmed that they have targeted soldiers in Ramim, actually, and also in the vicinity of Al Manara Post. And that barrack specifically is one of the very few times where Hezbollah also specifies that they know there was casualties, whether soldiers were either killed or wounded. Hezbollah does not usually say that since they could not really independently and directly verify that. But in this instance, this is one of the very few times where Hezbollah says in their statements that this operation led definitely to scores of Israeli soldiers killed or wounded. We also had another significant operation. Hezbollah used kamikaze drone to target a group of soldiers. Hezbollah said that they targeted an infantry that was preparing to go and be deployed in a certain area in the settlement of Ma'ayon Yaroch. And this is the first time, I think, that we have a targeting in that area specifically. Well, Hezbollah also targeted the settlement of Al-Baghdadi post specifically also. And so in addition to those Hezbollah operations, the Israelis continue with their shelling. We had very heavy shelling, actually, in the towns of Ramya and Beit Leaf. And today also we had a funeral for two civilians, a man and his wife, in their 60s. They were laid to rest today, and they were killed yesterday by Israeli strike in the town of Kafra. And that is one of the few times that that town specifically has also been targeted, since it is considered relatively far away from the border. Of course, we are seeing an escalation from the Israeli side. Hezbollah is also retaliating as a result of these Israeli shelling. But it seems that the situation is growing more and more volatile. We are seeing, like I said, more Israeli escalation. And the fact that the Israelis are hitting specific areas that are growing we're going to see that there are more and more civilian infrastructures that basically debunk all the calls and the reports that they have for their people, saying that they are targeting Hezbollah sites or manufacturing sites and so on. When the authorities go to check on those areas, they can see that there are only civilian infrastructure and civilian houses and residents that are being destroyed by the Israeli shelling, whether artillery or from its fighter jets.
Thanks a lot, Mariam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Elsewhere, Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza continues. Scores of Palestinians killed and hundreds more injured in the past 24 hours. In the latest attacks, Israeli forces targeted Al Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City in the center of the besieged strip, killing several civilians and leaving many others injured. The regime's forces also launched strikes on the southern cities of Rafah and Khan Yunis. The death toll from the Israeli onslaught on Gaza since October the 7th has now surpassed 30,200. More than 71,300 have also been injured. According to Gaza's health ministry, at least 13 children have so far starved to death in the besieged territory. International condemnations are pouring in over the Israeli massacre of innocent Palestinians scrambling for food and life-saving aid in northern Gaza.
For heaven's sake, put an end to killing civilians, children, women. According to the information that we have, dozens of them have bullets in their heads. It was intentionally targeting and killing. And the number that we have now is 112 have been killed, and the number is increasing, and 750 injured, and possibly the number would be increasing. This outrageous, massacre is a testimony to the fact that as long as the Security Council is paralyzed and vetoes casted, then it is costing the Palestinian people their lives.
The Secretary General condemns the incident today in northern Gaza, in which more than 100 people were reportedly killed or injured while seeking life-saving aid.
France has also reacted to the massacre, with the country's ambassador to the UN saying civilians and civilian infrastructure should never be targeted. China strongly condemned the Israeli crime of opening fire on aid seekers. Meanwhile, the Iranian Foreign Ministry said that people will never forget the plight of Gaza and the U.S. support for the Israeli genocide. Turkey, Egypt, and Jordan are among the regional countries that have condemned the carnage. Brazil's foreign ministry has also slammed the attack, calling for an end to such mass crimes across the besieged territory.
Humanity is failing the civilians of Gaza, and it is time to prevent further massacres. It is up to the international community to call a halt to it and to avoid new atrocities.
The statement also said the Israeli regime has once again proven that its onslaught in Gaza has no ethical or legal limits. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock also called on the Israeli occupation forces to open an investigation into the attack. The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs warned that life is, in his words, draining out of Gaza. South Africa said the massacre violated international law and an order by the top UN court calling on Israel to avoid genocide. In Gaza, Israeli soldiers on Thursday opened fire on starving Palestinians who were waiting for aid delivery in Gaza, killing and wounding hundreds of them. Since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October, it has spared no one and no place, including homes, hospitals, schools, and mosques. In an act of defiance and resistance, Palestinians in the southern city of Rafah have been holding Friday prayers over the ruins of one such mosque called Al-Farouk. Let's take a listen to what some of them had to say.
This is an ideological war that affects many mosques and hospitals. Why destroy and bomb houses of God? What is the fault of the children who are orphaned in the face of this destruction and organized terrorism, covered by official international endorsement from states and from the West? These mosques refuse to be silenced, and the call to prayer will continue to resound, growing louder. Despite this occupier and their arrogance, we must uphold God's rituals and continue to hold Friday prayers in this place.
Our message to the entire Islamic nation is to look at the condition of Muslims and the state of the mosques in the Gaza Strip. The occupation may have destroyed nearly 500 mosques or more. Now, out of 1,250 mosques in the Gaza Strip, almost half have been destroyed by the occupation. Our message to the Islamic and Arab nations is that they must include these mosques in their future plans so that we can rebuild the houses of God, and hold prayers, Friday prayers, and congregational prayers in them, and tease the enemies to establish mosques again.
We pray in this place because I opened my eyes to this mosque since I was young. At the age of 6, I used to pray in this mosque. We're residents of this area. The mosque is not even 200 meters from my house, and we have prayed in it all our lives, even when it was bombed. It is not enough for them to destroy the morale of the Palestinian people, demolish homes, kill people, and wipe out entire families. But this is not just the goal of the Israeli aggression on mosques. Rather, the goal is to prevent the spread of religion and Islamic awareness among the people.
Intense battles are also continuing on the ground in Gaza, with Palestinian resistance fighters repelling attacks by Israeli forces. The military wing of the Islamic Jihad has released a new video showing its fighters clashing with Israeli soldiers in and around Al Zaytun neighborhood in the Gaza city. The Al-Quds brigades also launched mortar shells at a gathering of the regime's soldiers in northern Gaza near the Erez crossing. Also in the north, the Mujahideen brigades hit a Merkava tank with missiles. The resistance groups also said they'd shot down an Israeli drone in the southeastern part of the Gaza Strip. Tel Aviv says a total of 242 Israeli soldiers have been killed since the ground fighting began in Gaza in late October. Palestinian resistance groups, however, say Israel is concealing the actual number, which is much higher. People have once again taken to the streets across Yemen to show support for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip in the cities of Sa'ada and Sana'a. People waved Palestinian flags and chanted slogans against Israel and its main supporter, the U.S. The protesters have been holding rallies on Friday since Israel launched its genocidal war in early October. They held pictures of their leaders in a show of support for their pro-Palestine operations. Those operations have targeted Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea in an effort to pressure the regime to stop its genocide in Gaza. The Yemeni protesters also voiced support for their army's operations against U.S. and U.K. ships in response to their ongoing airstrikes on Yemen. The airstrikes began in the wake of Yemeni attacks in the Red Sea. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. According to a report, hundreds of people, including children and victims of trafficking and torture, have been convicted and jailed for arriving in the United Kingdom in small boats to claim asylum. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new report, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's asylum laws have introduced a perma-backlog of up to 55,000 people who cannot have their claims processed and risk being left indefinitely in taxpayer-funded temporary accommodation. The Institute for Public Policy Research said that anyone arriving in the United Kingdom via irregular means after 20th of July 2023 cannot have their claim processed and instead will be removed to their home country or to a third country such as Rwanda following the introduction of the Illegal Migration Act. At the same time, pre-existing laws mean that irregular arrivals since 7th of March 2023 cannot be given permission to stay. The think tank said reports suggest that these claims are also on hold. The report says it is highly doubtful that the small country of Rwanda will ever be able to accept tens of thousands of people. Marley Morris, Associate Director for Migration at the Institute for Public Policy Research, said chaos in the Home Office has led to tens of thousands of asylum seekers stuck in a perma-backlog, unable to get on with their lives and costing the taxpayer millions of pounds. This was an entirely predictable outcome of the Illegal Migration Act. The only way to escape this situation is for the Home Office to start processing claims. The Institute for Public Policy Research's warning came as James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, said wealthy nations must help developing ones avoid hemorrhaging people. In a speech in New York on Tuesday, 27th of February, James Cleverly said Western powers must help would-be migrants to stay and thrive at home in order to stem the international migration crisis. Answering questions afterwards, he said there could be large-scale migration to Europe from Africa, the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia, as they become richer and people who were previously too poor to consider relocation acquire the financial means to do so. James Cleverly said, as these parts of the world become wealthier, there may be an initial but potentially temporary pressure for large-scale human movement to the high GDP per capita countries. He argued that Western powers should support these countries in ensuring they are safe and prosperous to prevent an outflow of people and a devastating talent drain. He said, "If you're a country with great aspiration for your future, but what you're synonymous for is just people hemorrhaging from your country, that contradicts your message." An expert in migration questioned James Cleverly's plan. Madeleine Sumption, the director of the Migration Observatory, said research suggested development policies were not an effective way to reduce migration. She added, "It's usually not the very poorest people who migrate, because migrating requires resources. So if low-income countries get richer, sometimes that leads to more migration and not less." She added, "Countries have to become pretty wealthy before people stop wanting to emigrate in substantial numbers. If governments knew how to implement development policies that could achieve that, they'd have done it already." A spokesperson for the Home Office claimed, "We met the Prime Minister's pledge to clear the legacy backlog of asylum cases made before 28th of June 2022, and all of those cases have been reviewed. Now we're working through the next cohort of applications." The spokesperson asserted, "We're beginning to implement measures in the Illegal Migration Act following the Supreme Court judgment on Rwanda and alongside the Safety of Rwanda Bill going through Parliament, delivering against this government's priority of tackling illegal migration." The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a report, hundreds of people, including children and victims of trafficking and torture, have been convicted and jailed for arriving in the United Kingdom in small boats to claim asylum. The prosecutions have largely slipped under the radar, although the issue has been highlighted by the case of the Senegalese teenager Ebrahim Abar. He was sentenced to 9 years and 6 months detention after being convicted of 4 counts of manslaughter and 1 of facilitating a breach of immigration law after steering an overcrowded dinghy that got into difficulty, leading to the drowning of at least 4 people. The report, called No Such Thing as Justice Here, from the Centre for Criminology at the University of Oxford and Border Criminologists, examined the cases of people who have been imprisoned for their arrival on a small boat since the Nationality and Borders Act of 2022 came into force. It used a mix of attendance at more than 100 court hearings, as well as freedom of information requests and interviews with lawyers, convicted asylum seekers, convicted and interpreters. The non-governmental organisations Humans for Rights Network, Captain's Support UK and Refugee Legal Support contributed to the report. It found that the prosecutions have not acted as a deterrent for channel crossings and calls for an end to criminalisation at the border. Between June of 2022 and October of 2023, 253 people were convicted under Section 24 of the 1971 Immigration Act for illegal entry and 7 under Section 25 of that Act for facilitation. According to the research, those targeted for prosecution were either boat drivers like Ebrahim Abar or had immigration history in the United Kingdom, such as having made a previous visa application. In 2021, a series of successful appeals overturned prosecutions under these sections of the 1971 Immigration Act. In response, in June of 2022, the Nationality and Borders Act expanded the scope of criminal offences relating to irregular arrival to the United Kingdom. The offence of illegal arrival was introduced, with a maximum sentence of 4 years imprisonment, and the offence of facilitation was expanded, with a maximum sentence increased from 14 years to life imprisonment. In 2022, one person for every 10 boats was arrested for their alleged role in steering. In 2023, this increased to one for every 7 boats. People have been identified as having their hand on the tiller for many reasons, including having boating experience, steering in return for discounted passage, taking it in turns, or being under duress. Those arrested included people from countries with a high asylum grant rate, including Sudan, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Eritrea, and Syria. Children in age disputes have been charged as adults with the offences of illegal arrival and facilitation for their alleged role in steering boats across the channel. Humans for Rights Network has identified 15 age-disputed children who were wrongly treated as adults following Home Office age assessments and charged with these new offences, with 14 of them spending time in adult prison. They believe there are likely to be more cases. So far, 5 have been confirmed to be children, and the outcome of age assessments is awaited for the others.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. In addition to the status of the Ahlul Bayt, in order for us to become true soldiers of the Imam, we decided to take on a heavy task as a community. We decided to relearn our beliefs from the Quran itself, to go over a book together, and to have this be a learning experience, retraining ourselves, retraining our hearts and souls. Isn't easy. It's not always easy to give up something that we've learned from before. A different way of thinking, to embrace it, to learn to think as God wants us to think, to feel as Allah says feel, and to see the world as Allah wants us to see the world. It's not easy. It is something that requires effort, requires willingness, and it even requires dua. So before we begin the book that we're going to be covering, brothers and sisters, it's a very beautiful dua. Again, we're asking Allah to open our hearts so that we can embrace Quran and Sunnah. There are sometimes definitions that we'll find which are different than the way we grew up, what we heard in Sunday school, right? But the idea is to read these things together. So that very beautiful dua is this. We start off with salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Wa arim al-haq. This is from Imam Sadiq. Oh Allah, show me the truth to be truth. Hatta attabi'ahu. Show me the truth to be truth. So I embrace it. I accept it. I follow it. What else? Wa arim al-batil. Batila. Show me falsehood to be falsehood. We're going to come with an open heart and mind. We're going to be reading these verses of the Quran. I'll be pointing out these Quranic stories. And after that, I will be asking brothers and sisters to see, what do we get from these verses? Because we're going to go directly, inshallah, to the Quran. So we're asking that we see batil to be batil, hatta ajtanibahu, so that we can avoid batil and stay away from batil. Now, because we're doing that, then I do have one thing that I'd like to share before we start. Alhamdulillah, remembering the five holy personalities, and because of the birth of our Imam, I don't know how many of you were able, well, those of you who speak Farsi were definitely able to. Some of you would have, I'm sure this it's been translated as well. I don't know how many of us got a chance to see the interview of Qasim Soleimani. There's one last interview that he does where he talks about the 33-day war. Again, let's not forget our principle. The idea is, if you have taqwa, you do your job. There are certain things you can't see. There are certain things you can't plan for. Out of the reach of your aql, God will act as your eyes and ears. Just as an example of this promise. So if brothers and sisters remember, he's explaining the beginning of the 33-day war, and he says that we went in there initially, and our job was just to exercise taqwa. What was our taqwa? We had brothers who were captured by Israel. No way of freeing these prisoners. It was our responsibility. Taqwa meant, go rescue them. So they went into Israel, they got the Hummer, they captured the Israeli soldiers with the idea of, we'll exchange them. They had no idea that Israel had been planning a game-changing war to depopulate Lebanon of the Shia population. They didn't know that. They were trying to do their responsibility. Taqwa of Allah. Because of that, they were ready when Israel responded. But they had no idea. Right? You exercise taqwa, God acts as your eyes and ears. Taqwa, brothers and sisters, is now another verse of the Quran. Taqwa, Quranic taqwa, makes you a giant killer. You're able to move mountains with the help of Allah with taqwa. That first verse that I mentioned to brothers and sisters, there were multiple verses in the Quran that said that. This one also, more than once in the Quran, Allah repeats it. Let's see if I can give you one more example. Surah Baqarah again, So surah number 2. And brothers and sisters, if the address that I'm giving you is incorrect, please share so that I can correct it. Surah Baqarah and verse number 194. God says this in the Quran. End of the verse. Wa'lamu, know this. Anna Allah, truly Allah, ma'al muttaqeen. God Himself, the Lord of the universe, is on the side and with those who have taqwa. Why is it that you say we can move mountains? Because if I get Quranic, we haven't described what Quranic taqwa is. But if I can have that, God is with me. Wa'alamu, know this, that God is with those who have taqwa. There's another reason why taqwa needed to be discussed before iman. So the book that we're having, brothers and sisters, if you look at it, the book is going to first talk about taqwa. After that, it's going to talk about iman. What is true iman? What are the promises of God for mu'mineen? After that, it'll talk about what is tawheed, then nubuwa, then wilayah, it'll go on, right? To reaffirm our Quranic beliefs. Why is it, question, why is it that the leader would talk about taqwa, right? Fear of God or God-wariness, we have to describe what that is, before he talks about iman. We're talking about, there's a book of faith, right? Aqidah, getting the correct aqidah. Why talk about taqwa first? Another key element to taqwa, and I'm going to show you the verse of the Quran, is that taqwa is, of course, it needs to be there from the beginning of our spiritual journey till the end. But taqwa ensures divine guidance. Taqwa ensures divine guidance. More than that, and I want to share a little bit with you, taqwa is necessary before faith. The leader will explain. There are some people who have taqwa before they formally become Muslim. The person who has taqwa will become Muslim. What does that mean? Taqwa before iman. Absolutely. How? What's the definition? Right? But if that taqwa can be there, then that also will lead to faith. Okay. So now, what happens is, I didn't share the verse. Let's see if this verse is also correct. We're going to talk about this later. Right? So Surah Baqarah, so it's Surah number 2, and verse number 2. ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابِ, that is the book, right? The Quran. That is the book. لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ, there is no doubt in it. هُدًى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ, it is a source of guidance for those who have taqwa. Even those who, before Islam, had a level of taqwa, those people will be able to benefit. There are some people, and the Quran is going to describe them. I'm going to give you a Quranic story about some people who find no benefit in the Quran. Who are those people? Who are these people? Quranic stories. Anyhow, now, the way the leader describes taqwa, right, because we're redefining these terms, first he's going to start off by explaining what taqwa is not. We're going to learn a Quranic story, right? What is not taqwa? What's not taqwa?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali الحالي حاكم المتين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد. يا مؤمني صل عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump, his adult sons, and former Trump Organization officials have appealed a civil fraud judgment in New York. The former president's lawyers asked New York State's mid-level appeals court to overturn Judge Arthur Engoron's verdict. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Cable broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump, his adult sons, and two former Trump Organization officials have appealed the $464 million judgment entered against them in the New York Attorney General's civil fraud case. The Trumps filed a notice of appeal with the court on Monday, 26th of February. The first business day after Judge Arthur Engoron made the judgment official. Donald Trump is personally on the hook for $454 million, including interest payments. In the court filing, the attorney said they were appealing the money, judgment, and other relief, including the bans against the Trumps for serving as officers of New York corporations for a period of years, and whether the judge committed errors of law and or fact, abused its discretion, and or acted in excess of its jurisdiction. It was not immediately clear how Donald Trump planned to cover the money needed for the appeal. Trump will need to put up cash or post bond to cover the $355 million and an additional roughly $100 million in interest payments he was ordered to pay. His sons were each ordered to pay more than $4 million back in gains they improperly received because of the fraud. If he does not provide all those dollars, then that interest is going to keep ticking throughout the entirety of the case, said Jeremy Salland, a criminal defense attorney. The bottom line is that he's in trouble. He doesn't have to put up the money to appeal. He puts up the money to stop bleeding more money. The way to cover that wound is with cash, Salland said. Interest accrues at an annual rate of 9% until the payment is made in full, according to lawyers. If Donald Trump posts a bond, which could be backed by properties or other assets, it stops the Attorney General from seizing his property. Donald Trump could also ask the appeals court to stay the judgment or ask them to not require him to post the money until later. Some lawyers say it's more common for companies to have to post judgments of this amount, but the sheer size of it for an individual is in some ways uncharted territory. The Trump Organization is a private entity and much about its financial state is closely guarded. Donald Trump said under oath last year that he had more than $400 million in excess cash. The New York Attorney General's office said in court filings last year that in 2021, Donald Trump had about $200 million in cash tied up in a partnership with Vornado. If Trump were to sell a property to raise money, that could take months, may require approval by the monitor put in place as a result of the investigation, and requires signing off by the Attorney General, Letitia James. It would also likely result in a large tax bill. If Trump's appeal is successful, or the court reduces the amount of money owed, he would be able to recover money he has posted down the road. Judge Arthur Engoron's signed judgment was posted to the court docket on Friday, 1 week after he found Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and Eric Trump liable for fraud in the civil case brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. The judge denied a request from Trump to delay the judgment for 30 days, saying they didn't explain or justify a reason to do so. His lawyers had argued it would harm the New York Attorney General's office and would allow for an orderly process given the magnitude of the decision. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump has appealed his $454 million New York civil fraud judgment, challenging a judge's finding that the former president lied about his wealth as he grew the real estate empire that launched him to stardom and the presidency. The former U.S. president's lawyers filed notices of appeal on Monday, 26th of February, asking New York State's Mid-Level Appeals Court to overturn Judge Arthur Engoron's 16th of February verdict in the lawsuit brought by the New York Attorney General Letitia James, and reverse staggering penalties that threaten to wipe out Donald Trump's cash reserves. Trump's lawyers wrote in court papers that they were asking the appeals court to decide whether Judge Arthur Engoron committed errors of law and or fact, and whether he abused his discretion or acted in excess of his jurisdiction. Trump's appeal paperwork did not address whether Donald Trump was seeking to pause collection of the judgment while he appeals by putting up money, assets, or an appeal bond covering the amount owed to qualify for an automatic stay. Messages seeking comment were left with Trump's lawyers and the New York Attorney General's office. Judge Arthur Engoron found that Donald Trump, his company, and top executives, including his sons Eric and Donald Trump Jr., schemed for years to deceive banks and insurers by inflating his wealth on financial statements used to secure loans and make deals. Among other penalties, the judge put strict limitations on the ability of Trump's company, the Trump Organization, to do business in New York State. The appeal ensures that the legal fight over Donald Trump's business practices will persist into the thick of the presidential primary season, and probably beyond, as he tries to clinch the Republican presidential nomination in his quest to retake the White House. If upheld, Judge Engoron's ruling will force Donald Trump to give up a sizable chunk of his fortune. Judge Engoron ordered Donald Trump to pay $355 million in penalties, but with interest, the total has grown to nearly $454 million. The total will increase by nearly $112,000 a day until he pays up. Trump maintains that he is worth several billion dollars, and testified last year that he had about $400 million in cash in addition to properties and other investments. New York Attorney General Letitia James, a Democrat, told ABC News that if Trump is unable to pay, she will seek to seize some of Donald Trump's assets. Trump's appeal was expected. Trump had vowed to appeal, and his lawyers had been laying the groundwork for months by objecting frequently to Judge Arthur Engoron's handling of the trial. During the trial, Trump's lawyers accused Judge Engoron of tangible and overwhelming bias. They have also objected to the legal mechanics of Letitia James's lawsuit. Trump contends the law she sued him under is a consumer protection statute that is normally used to rein in businesses that rip off their customers. Trump's lawyers have long argued that some of the allegations are barred by a statute of limitations, contending that Judge Arthur Engoron failed to comply with an appellate division ruling last year that he narrows the scope of the trial to weed out outdated allegations. If Donald Trump is unsuccessful at the appellate division, he can ask the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, to consider taking the case. The appeal is one of Trump's many legal challenges. He has been indicted on criminal charges 4 times in the last year. He's accused in Georgia and Washington, D.C. of plotting to overturn his 2020 election defeat to the Democrat Joe Biden. In Florida, he is charged with hoarding classified documents. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, justice and fight against corruption. These two virtues necessitate each other. Economic, moral, and political corruption are like tumors in the body of countries and governments. if found in the body of a system of governance, they would constitute a devastating quake and a heavy blow to their legitimacy. And for an establishment like the Islamic Republic that requires beyond the common legitimacy and social acceptance, this is far more serious and fundamental than for any other systems. The temptations of wealth, power, and rank weaken some, even in the most resembling of all governments to Imam Ali's governance, that is, Amir al-Mu'mineen's own government. Thus, the hazard posed by the emergence of such a threat in the Islamic Republic, whose officials once competed each other in revolutionary piety and maintaining a simple lifestyle, has never been and still is not far from probable. This makes the constant presence of an efficient organization with sharp eyes and decisive actions within the three branches of powers, executive, legislature, judiciary, necessary in order to truly fight corruption, especially in governmental bodies.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, the proportion of corrupt individuals among the officials of the Islamic Republic is much smaller than that of many other countries, and particularly to that of the Pahlavi regime, which was totally corrupt and encouraged corruption. And thanks be to God, the agents of this system have mostly stayed clean from it. However, even the slightest corruption is unacceptable. Everyone must know that economic transparency is the precondition for the legitimacy for all officials of the Islamic Republic. Everybody must beware of the evil of greed and avoid illegitimate earnings and supplicate to God to help them in this regard. Supervising and governmental organizations must prevent corruption from being conceived and fight its spread with sincerity and sensitivity.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.